This evening, we want to study chapter 6 and 7 of Genesis, which record the moral degeneration and deterioration which took place before the flood, and the flood then, which came as a punishment for that deterioration. We're told that men began to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters were born to them, so that we have an increasingly larger population coming into being. There are some people who have done some estimates on the basis of the length of lives of the patriarchs and the number of children which they might potentially have brought into the world. They suggest that the population of the earth at the time of the flood may well have been 1 billion or even 2 billion. They suggest that the population of the pre-diluvian world then may have come very close to the population of the world which we know today. In any case, we are told that men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and that with this multiplication in number, there came a multiplication in their wickedness and in the evil that characterized them. The second verse of chapter 6 is one which gives us a bit of trouble at times. We're told the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife such of them as they chose. This has to be tied in with the fourth verse, when we're told the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And the Nephilim here seems to be a reference to giants or a race of giants. And we're told then that when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them, these were then the mighty men of old, men of renown. Now, there are some critics who suggest that we have here a myth similar to the myths of ancient peoples. It's not uncommon among the Greeks and the Romans to read stories of the gods who came down to earth and married some fair-eyed and fair-haired maiden, and that then the great heroes of those days, of the myths of the Roman and Greek peoples, were the offspring of these marriages between gods and human beings. And so people say that here we have a similar situation in the Bible, that there is a reference to the sons of God, that they married the daughters of men, that giants were the offspring of these marriages, and that these then became the mighty men of old that were men of renown. The traditional explanation of this has always been that the sons of God refer to the family of Seth. These were the people who were fundamentally and basically loyal to Yahweh, the true God. And the daughters of men are children of the family of Cain, the descendants of Cain that were characterized throughout as a race of people who were rebellious against God. So, we've always said that what is recorded here is an intermarriage of the family of Seth, the family that was loyal to the true God, and the family of Cain, which was rebellious and at odds with God. Now, the problem then seems to be that instead of listening to God's warnings and instead of protecting themselves against the close association with people who were notorious for their wickedness, that the people who should have known better, people who were of the family of Seth, who were loyal to Yahweh, to the true God, nevertheless disregarded his warnings and intermarried with the family of Cain. The family of Cain, as we noted last time, was famous for its abilities in both the arts and the sciences. This resulted in these men of renown, these great heroes, but men who were disloyal to the true God, men and women who were then in the line of Cain rather than in the line of Seth. And it is for this reason that the Lord says, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh, but his days shall be 120 years. There is a problem in connection also with this 120 years. If you go back to chapter 5, verse 32, you are told that after Noah was 500 years old, he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And you are told that when Noah was 600 years old, the flood began. Luther had a problem with this. You couldn't get 120 years in here. If you had Noah 500 years old, and then God saying, "I'm going to give them another 120 years, and the flood comes after 100 years. So Luther solved the problem by suggesting that the earth was so evil that God didn't even give them the 120 years to repent, that at the end of 100 years, the situation was so bad that God decided that he had to interfere, and that he interfered then by sending the flood, let's say, 20 years earlier than he had planned to send it. I don't think that this is the explanation. I don't think that this is a satisfactory way of solving the problem. Let me tell you of one other way that has been used to solve the problem that I feel has some difficulties in it, but let me mention it just for the sake of completeness. There are some who believe that this is not talking about the time that would elapse until the flood came, but that rather God here is setting a limit on the lifespan of man. What God is essentially saying is these human beings are around too long and they get into trouble. Up until this time, they've had a lifespan of 900 years or close to it, and from now on, I'm going to cut that back, and it's only going to be 120 years as a maximum lifespan. These people suggest that this maximum still holds today, that the maximum lifespan is 120 years and that the average lifespan is that outlined for us in the 90th Psalm, where Moses tells us that the days of our years are to be 70 or 80 years. That's an average, they say. But the absolute maximum is 120. And so they suggest that here God is setting the maximum and saying no more are men going to be around for 900 or 800 or 700 years. From now on, I'm only going to let them live 120 years. The only problem with that explanation is that we do have men living more than 120 years after this. So I'm not satisfied with that explanation either. It seems to me that in chapter 5, we're rounding off a subject. Chapter 5 purports to give us the names of the men who lived in this period of time. And I believe that Moses is rounding off that topic to report the birth of Shem, Ham, and Japheth at the time that Noah was 500 years old. Now, I don't believe that these are triplets by any means. I believe that what God is telling us here through Moses is that when Noah was 500 years old, his first son was born, because that's the pattern that is followed earlier in the text. The firstborn is obviously the one who is mentioned, and his father's age is given at the time that the firstborn came into the world. It isn't only the firstborn of Noah who is mentioned here, but his three sons are mentioned because of the importance they play in the later history. It seems to me then that Noah was 500 years old when his first son was born. Then I believe that chapter 6 backs up and takes God's decision, which was made even before children were born to Noah. Let's say arbitrarily, when Noah was 480 years old, God reached this decision that man would have only 120 more years, and that then the flood would come. Now, these next verses are simply, in a very monotonous way, tell us about how evil the world had become. We're told that the Lord saw the wickedness of man, that it was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And then we're told that the Lord God was sorry that he had made man. It grieved him to his heart. Here was the foremost of his visible creatures. And as a result of the efforts of his enemy Satan, he had deteriorated so much. Men had become so evil that God felt that the only solution was to blot out these wicked human beings. What's interesting, too, is that not only is man to suffer as a result of his wickedness, but the rest of the created world also suffers. I believe we can see that in our own day, too, where it isn't only man who suffers, but all of the created world suffers. The animals of the world are destroyed as a result of man's evil. He exploits the earth. He wants to use it for his own material gain. And as a result, the animals are wiped out. They suffer. The plants suffer because of man's exploitation of his environment, because he's selfish and materialistic. Even the inorganic world, the air, the water, the minerals, suffer because of man's wickedness and because of his exploitation. And here it was, at the time of the flood, the same situation going on. Because of man's sin, the birds of the air and the creeping things and the beasts are to be wiped out, not only a man. We note, though, that Noah, we are told, has found favor and that God decides that he will save him. Now, once more, you have the same monotonous record of man's evil reported here in verse 11. The earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw that the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. What is striking here is how repetitive this is. God is thoroughly disgusted. He just can't get over what has happened, how evil and how wicked and how corrupt his creation has become. But because Noah is still loyal to Yahweh, Noah is to be saved. And God then communicates to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. And the command then to Noah to build the ark so that Noah will be protected. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. We don't know what that gopher wood was. It seems to have been a particularly sturdy wood, possibly somewhat impervious to water, a wood that would withstand the violence of the storms that must have racked the world at the time of the flood. It's to be covered inside and outside with pitch and in that way protected against leakage. The dimensions are rather interesting. We're told that it's to be 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, 30 cubits high. We don't know exactly what a cubit was equal to in our measurement. There are several measures of the cubit which we find in recorded history. In many cases, the cubit was the distance from the finger of the king to his elbow. And of course then your measures would vary with the king. If he was a big man and had a long forearm and the distance from his elbow to his longest finger was great, you had a pretty good cubit. And if he was a short fellow, the cubit would be shortened. It does seem as if a reasonable standard for the cubit was about 18 inches, a foot and a half. And on that basis, you will see that the ark was indeed a tremendous vessel, 300 cubits long, which means it was 450 feet long, 50 cubits wide, which means it was 75 feet wide, and 30 cubits high, which means that it was at least 45 feet high. Now, it could be that these dimensions are even on the short side, and it may be that the cubit was actually longer. But even if we take cubits of 18 inches, we find that this was a large boat. I believe, too, that it had decks. In fact, we know that it had decks. And the height of 45 feet would make it possible to have these decks so that there would be plenty of room for storage. The text itself tells us that there were three decks, a lower, second, and third deck. And this, of course, would give it a tremendous carrying capacity so that it could accomplish God's purpose in keeping the human race and all animals alive so that the earth could be repopulated after the flood. Now, you notice here that Noah was commanded to bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive. Later on, we're told that the command with the clean animals was that there were to be seven. This provision was made so that there would be animals available more quickly for sacrifice, presumably. And Noah was also commanded that he was to take food into the ark, to store it there, food which would enable the people who were on the ark to survive over the long period of time that they were going to have to be there. As we'll see, they had to be there a little over a year. Now, what's interesting is that they were commanded to take in the animals, and this is a reference to mammals. They were also commanded to take in the birds. There's no reference to the fishes. There is a reference to the creeping things, and these are the categories that we have in the Bible, the animals or mammals, the creeping things, which obviously refers to amphibia and reptiles, and the birds. There's no reference to the fish, so we don't have to worry about the problem of what happened to the fish. It is not at all implausible that they survived because they were in a medium which was not being destroyed. But the birds and the animals lived in a medium that was being destroyed, and therefore they had to be protected. God now commands Noah to go into the ark. You and your household, he says, for I've seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Here we have the command to take the seven pairs of the clean animals, presumably again, so that there would be food for one thing immediately after the flood, and the other thing so that there would be sacrifice. And God tells them, you've got 7 days, and in 7 days I'm going to send rain upon the earth, 40 days and 40 nights. Every living thing is going to be blotted out from the face of the earth. It's in verse 6 then that we're told that Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came upon the earth. He was 500 years old when his sons were born. They were 100 years old at this time, or at least the oldest was 100 years old at this time. In verse 11, we have a very exact chronological reference. We're told that in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of heaven were opened, and rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. It's very clear that this is meant to be history. If it were an allegory, you wouldn't have this detail of the exact age of Noah at the time that the deluge broke loose. If this were meant to be a parable or an allegory, you'd simply say that Noah was 600 years old. You might not even say that. But you certainly would not point to the exact day in his life that this event began. The three sons of Noah and their wives enter with Noah into the ark. The animals enter in, and the picture, of course, that we have is that they came to Noah at God's command. It isn't as if Noah had to go and get them. I don't think we have to believe that they came marching along in twos. You've all seen this picture of the gangplank going up, and the animals march in by twos. Not at all necessary that this is the way it happened, but by God's command, they came to Noah, and Noah then led them into the ark, and in that way, they were protected. You will notice, too, that God himself closed up the ark, because we're told that after they had entered in, the Lord shut them in. For 40 days and for 40 nights, it rained. And as we indicated earlier, it may well be that this was the first rain that the earth knew. As I indicated earlier, it's quite possible that prior to the flood, there was no rain, but that the earth was supplied with moisture through this mist that went up from the earth. And it's quite possible that this is the way in which the rather luxuriant vegetation, which we assume existed before the flood, was provided with moisture. As I indicated at that time, it's very easy to conceive of a situation where there would be enough moisture for rather lush growth, even though there was no rain. So I'm inclined to believe that there was no rain prior to the flood. And I'm inclined to believe that this is what's referred to by the waters that were above the firmament up in the sky. I think they then came down and supplied the water that made up the flood. We're told that the waters prevailed so mightily upon the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered, and that the waters prevailed upon the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. Now, there are those who say that just shows you the impossibility of this having been a worldwide flood, because if you would calculate the amount of water that would be necessary to cover all the mountains, including Mount Everest, to a height of 15 cubits, that would require far too much water, and it would simply make the earth too heavy. I don't think that it's necessary to deny the universality of the flood on that basis. For one thing, God could certainly provide that the earth would not be thrown out of orbit if this weight were necessary. But to me, the very striking thing is that I don't believe that the mountains were necessarily as high as they are today. I can conceive of the mountains being much lower. I believe that it's quite plausible to assume that mountain building has gone on in the past, even as it is going on at present, and that Mount Everest may not have been as high as it is today. Indeed, no mountain may have been as high. Now, I'm not suggesting that we had a billiard ball earth. There certainly were mountains, but they need not have been as high as the mountains which we know today. We're told that all flesh died that moved upon the earth. And you notice the catalog, the birds, the cattle, the beasts, the swarming creatures that swarm upon the earth, apparently a reference to insects, and every man, everything on the dry land in whose nostrils the breath of life was, died. Now notice, this answers the question of those who ask what happened to the fish. They were not involved in this. But you notice that the birds are included, and of course they would have drowned if they had had to land on the water and would not have been able to find any resting place. Only Noah was left and those with him in the ark. And then we are told that the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Now, there are those who argue that what we have referred to here is a local flood in the Mesopotamian basin, a flood in the valley of the Tigris and the Euphrates. And you will find people from time to time writing accounts of where they found evidence of the flood. They'll tell you that they found a deposit in the Mesopotamian valley, which indicates flooding at a particular period of time, and often they'll do their calculations and come up with a time which they think fits with the flood that is reported here in the book of Genesis. And so they will say that the great flood occurred in a year so-and-so B.C., and that they have evidence of this from the silt deposits in the valley of the Tigris and Euphrates. What they are trying to insist upon is that we have here an account of a local flood. They say there is no evidence of any worldwide flood, and they insist on the fact that the flood here is a local flood, and that what we have referred to is a flood in the valley of the Tigris and the Euphrates. But that won't fit with the text, you see. Every evidence points to the fact that this is a worldwide flood. There's no evidence in the text at all that suggests that it was a local flood. But you have the waters covering all the mountains, all the high mountains, under the whole heaven. So that the emphasis is on the in the text is on the universality of the flood. The other thing that you have to remember is the purpose of the flood. The purpose is to wipe out mankind. It's not just a local population which is evil, but all of the people on earth are evil, and God's judgment is being expressed on all of them. So it's a worldwide catastrophe that cannot be confined to a given locality. St. Peter refers to the flood as a foretaste of the end of the earth, and calls attention to the fact that just as only a few people were saved in the flood, so by God's grace, relatively few are going to be saved. But he emphasizes the fact that the flood gives us a picture, an advanced picture of the end of the earth. And he emphasizes that too, that all men were destroyed in the flood. So it's very clear from the text that we have a worldwide catastrophe. And this was not a local flood, but its purpose was to wipe out all of mankind.